This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining me here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. Online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com as well. Dwight Falk with you here today on this Trumpet Radio Live weekend edition. Abraham Blondeau, Grant Turgeon, otherwise active today, other activities going on. So they are not with us today. Will be joining us again next week, however. You can follow us on Twitter if you'd like to at KPCGFM. We always appreciate getting some followers there. We send out tweets about programming here on KPCG. We don't overwhelm you, but we'll send you a few to keep you in the loop. And also, if you'd like to send in any emails, you can send those to comments at kpcg.fm. And we appreciate getting those. Got a few over the last several days, some interesting stories. Can't always get to all of them, but we're going to talk about one of them later today. So a lot of times, listeners see some interesting stories out there, and they like to send those in. We appreciate those. They can be sent to comments at kpcg.fm. Look at some of the headlines going on today. A little bit of news out of Germany to start. They have some flooding going on over there. Here in central Oklahoma, where we're broadcasting from, the campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College, we could use some rain and haven't had too much lately, but other parts are dealing with too much, including Germany. Torrential rains across northern and eastern Germany have left roads flooded, highways blocked, and firefighters answering countless emergency calls. They say firefighters in Berlin declared a state of emergency in the German capital after hundreds of phone calls started coming in on Thursday afternoon seeking help with flooded basements and underground parking spaces. It's always a trick, I guess, if you've got a basement. Maybe you've experienced this yourself. Get a lot of rain. It's going to go somewhere. A lot of times it goes into those basements. One of Berlin's busiest highways, the A100, had to be shut down for hours because of the deluge. There were no reports of injuries, thankfully, and maybe you've been in a situation like that where you're on the highway, the rain is coming down to the point where you can't see, and a lot of times people will pull over. I've had to do that myself. It's smarter to do that. Some people keep driving through it, but sometimes it rains so hard you can't see where you're going. They say the eastern states of Brandenburg and Thuringia, as well as the city of Hanover and smaller towns in northern Germany, also reported flooded homes and streets due to heavy rains. So they're getting quite a bit of rain over there in Germany, but no injuries or problems at this point. Some bigger news out of Germany. This was on the news update at the top of the hour. Gay marriage is now legalized in Germany. German lawmakers have voted to legalize same-sex marriage in a snap vote only days after Chancellor Angela Merkel changed her long-standing position. A lot of people have had a history of doing that lately, changing those long-standing positions where they've been against homosexual marriages, and then they change their position. That's happened in the U.S. Quite a few politicians. This is happening in Germany. The popular feeling out there in most places is that people should do that, and so the politicians, they are quick to jump on board in a lot of cases because they don't want to be considered an enemy of that group. Lawmakers voted 393 for legalizing marriage for everybody, as they say, and 226 against, with 4 abstentions. I guess it couldn't be for everybody. You can't have children marrying, but who knows? That's the way they worded it. Merkel herself voted against the measure, but paved the way for Friday's vote after saying on Monday that lawmakers could take up the issue as a question of conscience. So she didn't herself go and say she would agree with it, but she allowed it to go through the government. And it freed members of her conservative coalition, which has been against same-sex marriage, to individually vote for it. So it kind of played both sides there. Germany had allowed same-sex couples to enter civil partnerships since 2001. So it's been going on for quite some time, 16 years. But same-sex marriages remained illegal. All of Merkel's potential coalition partners after the 4th of September election, including the center-left Social Democrats of her challenger, Martin Schulz, have been calling for same-sex marriage to be legalized. So they went ahead and passed that in Germany. In case you're wondering, those types of relationships, termed LGBT relationships, are illegal in just over 70 countries right now in the world. And research also finds that in 12 countries, those types of relationships are still punishable by death. Depending on where you go in the world, things are handled very differently. And so that's a change that's been sweeping especially the West. And a great booklet to get is Redefining Family. You can get that at thetrumpet.com. And it highlights just the rapid change that we've seen. People are definitely redefining marriage, family, all of those institutions that have been, you know, pillars of society, but they're being turned on their head now. And it can get confusing for a lot of people if they're looking at those situations and trying to navigate this world when all the morals of the past have been thrown out. So make sure you look at that booklet, Redefining Families, at thetrumpet.com. It's free. You can read it, have it. You can request it right there. It'll be sent to you if you want it, or you can read it online, download the PDF, and lots of other ways to look at that material. Redefining Family, there at thetrumpet.com. Really important read, especially in this day and age. A couple other headlines here today. There's a lot of violence in the U.S. Of course, I think if you've watched the news, you've seen that in your local communities. We have a lot of listeners around the country, kpcg.fm. And so, I mean, even here locally in Oklahoma City, which isn't the biggest community, seems like so much violence on the nightly news. The local news, I would say probably the first 5 minutes are usually about some sort of crime that has occurred, and they could probably even talk about more, but just a lot happening there. And so there's all kinds of problems, including, of course, some of the violence up in Chicago. And that's been probably one of the more violent cities in the U.S. And so President Trump is now going to try to help that somewhat. This is from Fox News. Trump's feds now in Chicago to fight gun violence epidemic. Months after taking to Twitter to say he would send in the feds to help reduce Chicago's murder rate, President Trump's administration has sent in agents to combat the ongoing violence. Best of luck. It's tough, especially in some of those areas. Authorities confirmed Thursday to the Chicago Sun-Times about 20 additional agents with the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives have been sent to the city. Trump and Attorney General Jeff Sessions appeared to confirm Friday that the federal government is sending help while decrying the crime epidemic on the city streets. Crime and killings in Chicago have reached such epidemic proportions that I am sending in federal help, President Trump tweeted. 1,714 shootings in Chicago this year. 1,714 shootings so far in Chicago this year. Sounds like a war zone. It is a war zone. I mean, if that's just this year, I don't know if those numbers are exact, but that's what was tweeted. You know, we're only in, what, the last day of June here, at beginning of July. And so the year's only about halfway through. And we already had 1,714 shootings. I don't know if they're just counting this calendar year or, like, the last 12 months. But in any event, no matter how you look at it, that's a lot of shootings and a lot of violence there in Chicago. But then there's also the terrorist threat, of course, which is happening in Europe. It's also happening here in the U.S., always on guard against that, or trying to be, even in places that, I don't know, I wouldn't think of as having a problem with terrorism or potential terrorism, such as North Carolina. This is from the Charlotte Observer. They say feds confirm ISIS investigations underway in North Carolina, of all places. A domestic terrorism expert told The Observer this week that the North Carolina probes are among some 1,000 active FBI investigations into ISIS-related threats encompassing all 50 states. So looking at the entire U.S., there's about 1,000 active FBI investigations into just ISIS-related threats. So that's a lot of work. And, of course, you know, the attacks that happened in the U.K. recently, they knew, the government knew who the people were, I think, for most of them. But yet, either they didn't feel it was a pressing threat, or, you know, they had their eye on them, but still it didn't stop the problems. Court documents have shown that there's a few from just the Carolinas. Again, this is just articles focusing mainly on the North Carolina area. But the documents there show that the Carolinas have several alleged domestic ties to ISIS. So, I would think of a bigger city, but I wouldn't think of the Carolinas as being something where the threat would be there, but it is. A few incidents they talk about or situations. They say in May, unsealed court documents revealed that a Clemson graduate, FBI linguist, and a translator, so heavily involved there, was arrested in August 2014 after she married an ISIS operative that she was supposed to be monitoring. It sounds like a movie, right? This Clemson graduate, this linguist for the FBI, is supposed to be monitoring an ISIS operative and ends up marrying the guy. So just bizarre. She traveled to Syria in June 2014 to wed this guy. His name is Dennis Cuspert, and he goes by the name Dezo Dog. That's his nickname, I guess. And joined ISIS. She fled to the United States a few weeks later. I guess she didn't like what was going on. Was released in August 2016 after serving 2 years in prison. So that's somebody you would think would be very unlikely to be involved in something like that, but sure enough. Another example was a South Carolina teenager. Could go to trial as early as this fall for plotting to join ISIS in the Middle East and also threatening to launch a domestic massacre similar to what happened in Orlando. Just a young person in South Carolina, probably on social media, looking at some of these things going on and wanting to get involved in it. 2 years ago, when he was 16 and a high school student in York County, him and another suspect were charged with plotting to rob a gun store in North Carolina for an attack on troops at a military base near Raleigh. And so that's an ongoing case. There's a few other ones. Just people from the Carolina region, which, you know, is a beautiful area if you've ever been out there, But it's not a, you know, they don't have huge cities. There's some larger ones, but it's not like New York or Chicago, of course. And still, there's threats of terrorist activity and ISIS activity. So it just shows how far-reaching that is. Some potentially good news in relation to ISIS is this report that ISIS revenue has fallen 80% because the militants are losing ground in Iraq and Syria. So they're maybe on the way out to some extent. They say the self-declared caliphate has seen average monthly income plunge from $81 million in the second quarter of 2015 to just $16 million in the same period this year. That's still about $16 million too much. According to IHS Markit, it's a global data monitoring company. It provides analysis to businesses and governments. The report comes as Iraq declared the terror group had fallen after government forces recaptured a key mosque in the former ISIS stronghold of Mosul. So ISIS is on the run, I guess. Their funding is drying up somewhat, but there still is the threat of terrorism. And of course, if you've paid attention to, say, terrorist activity over the years, different groups pop up all the time. You know, one gets maybe kind of pushed down a little bit and another one pops up. So I don't know what this will necessarily do, but apparently they're on the run a little bit. But still there's that threat in all kinds of places around the world, but even but in the U.S., even in some more rural areas like out in the Carolinas. So something the FBI is continuing to look at. One other note here from this is from Illinois. And they have, of course, a lot of problems going on there with their government, with the budget, and the government's trying to work with that there locally. They say after decades of historic mismanagement, Illinois is now grappling with a $15 billion of unpaid bills and an unthinkable $250 billion owed to public employees when they retire. May not be a good time to retire. That money may not be coming. And that's a hard thing because people rely on that. They work their whole careers assuming that they're going to have some pension money there at the end. And those are usually pretty good pensions in a lot of cases. But it's where's it going to come from? That money just isn't there. So that's the problem that Illinois is facing. They say the budget crisis, this is from CNN, the budget crisis has forced Illinois to jack up property taxes so high that people are leaving in droves. I think some of the data showed that Cook County, I believe, I think that's where Chicago is, that area, they have the biggest flight of capital and people leaving. And you can understand why. You have, on one hand, you have extreme crime if you're down in those parts of the city. And also, you have property taxes that have been pushed so high to try to make up for this shortfall in pensions and other things. So people can't afford it or don't want to pay it, and so they're getting out of there. They say Illinois may soon have to take the unprecedented step of cutting off sales of lottery tickets. The unprecedented step, that's interesting. They should have stopped that a long time ago. But anyway, they try to get tax money from it and other funds. But they say they might have to cut that off because they won't be able to pay the winners. That would be a disappointment, I guess, if somebody was hoping to win the lottery and then they couldn't be paid for it. Moody estimates estimates that Illinois has unfunded pension liabilities totaling $251 billion. That's how much they owe to people that have put in their time, maybe for many, many years, working, expecting money to be there for their pensions, and they don't have the money for it. $251 billion. They say to put that into context, that's more than the combined market value of four major Illinois companies, Boeing, Caterpillar, United Continental, and Allstate. So those are obviously, those are name name brand companies, I guess you'd say, or household names, to where everybody knows those. Oh, Boeing, Caterpillar, United Continental, Allstate. That's a lot of money, right? Well, that's the unfunded pension liabilities is more than the combined market value of those four companies. So unbelievable. $251 billion. Sometimes I talk about how much money that would be if you were to take dollar bills and stack them. I don't have the figures on that. I should have looked at it, but that's always baffling. You know, it's like, I forget, but it's usually like to the moon and back or something. And it's just unbelievable to think about how much money that is and how much is owed to people. So it's going to be tough. They're in Illinois. They're trying to figure some things out. We'll see what they do as time moves on. We have a lot of listeners there in Chicago at kpcg.fm, so sorry about it. I hope you're in a better situation than that. It's a beautiful area, nice areas of that city even, where you can see a lot of pretty neat things, and they have museums and so forth, the Miracle Mile area, but it's not what it used to be. It's having all kinds of problems. Here's a couple of stories that are just a little more interesting, I think, in terms of some general information. You've probably seen, whether you've intended to or not, what they call professional wrestling. You probably flipped by it on TV at some point or something. Very popular in the 80s, had a little bit of a resurgence in the 2000s. I don't know if it's still considered to be popular today. I think there's a following. But where they, you know, they go out there, they're these made-up characters that they're trying to portray, and they have these wrestling matches, quote-unquote. Of course, it's staged, but still it's very, very violent. It's hard on the body and all of that. But it's, you know, it's a staged event. It's a sort of a theatrical presentation. Some people have said it's like a soap opera for men, I guess. But of course, all kinds of people do watch that. Well, so what they try to do, obviously, is it's sort of a psychology thing where there's a good guy and a bad guy, and you really, if you're a bad guy, you really want to draw what they call heat from the audience. You know, you want to come out there and really be booed and have everybody really want to see you lose, because they're going to pay tickets then to come watch you. And at the end of the day, they're trying to get a response. The good guy wants, you know, that response. And in order to be a good guy, you got to be fighting the bad guy. So the bad guy plays a big role, and he has to draw a lot of heat from the audience. So a lot of times what they'll do, these wrestlers or people coming up with the ideas, they'll take a look at something going on in society, and they'll try to be the bad guy in that scenario. For example, back in the 80s, there was the bad guy was usually a Russian. People were always mad at the Russians, and so the bad guy in a wrestling match would be a Russian, even though he probably came from Minnesota, as the case of one of the famous quote-unquote Russian wrestlers were. You know, they put on the act. Well, this is happening today. This is a Reddit from Fox News about this one guy. He's a professional wrestler, and he has become known as the progressive liberal. That is his character. He wears a T-shirt with photos of Hillary Clinton's face on it, the former Secretary of State, Senator, and First Lady. And he's drawing big-time attention in some of the nation's reddest of red states. So he goes around, and you talk about drawing some heat, right? There's a real political divide. So this guy is going around as his character is the progressive liberal. He wears a T-shirt that has Mrs. Clinton's face on it, and draws a lot of heat from the audience. His name is Daniel Harnsberger. He's a Virginia real estate agent by day, so he's got like this double career, double job going on. He represents Appalachian Mountain Wrestling, so it's kind of, I guess, a smaller outfit. It's not what you'd maybe see on the bigger television networks. But he goes by the stage name of Daniel Richards, the Progressive Liberal, a moniker printed on the back of his trunks, and he routinely taunts audiences in conservative states by denouncing country music and telling the crowd that they are uneducated and backward. So that's kind of an age-old ploy. You know, they come out, they insult the audience, get them all mad, and then they'll probably end up losing to the good guy, and so it makes the good guy look really good, and the audience gets excited. So that's part of his shtick. And so he comes out to the audience there in this Appalachian event, and he says, I understand now why you all identify with country music. It's slow and simple, and it's boring, just like each and every one of you. So you can imagine the audience doesn't like hearing that. They say the crowd appears to relish Richard's bravado, and because it lets them give as good as they get from him, so they like to boo and yell at him. He said, I'm having a great time. I'm enjoying it. He said, there's an entertainment aspect to me about weaving political statements, taking shots at conservatives into his wrestling performances. So it's being done as a theatrical sort of presentation. I don't know what the guy thinks personally about anything, but that's what happens. I mean, people that are trying to entertain the crowd in some fashion, they look at something going on in society and they make a character about it. And so this is one of the hot button issues, right? Politics. So that's kind of an interesting take. In some ways, it might be really smart for him to do that. Obviously, he gets a lot of attention. He got on Fox News. People are going to want to come out, I guess, and boo him. But at the same time, it's pretty dangerous, too, because it is a very heated climate. So anyway, he's doing it for now. He is a professional wrestler. Daniel Harnsberger goes by Daniel Richards, the progressive liberal. So and he tours around and wrestles in the red states. So he's having fun and making money for now. So that's, I thought it was kind of an interesting story. Here's one other note that's interesting. If you like records and playing records, and maybe you have a record player, they actually sell the record players again. I've seen them in stores and records. This says there's a vinyl comeback, Sony to produce records again after a 28-year break. Everything old is new again, I guess. Despite the current popularity of digital music services like Spotify, old school records are enjoying a renaissance. Consulting firm Deloitte forecasts the vinyl music industry will post double-digit growth in 2017 for the seventh year in a row, selling 40 million new discs and generating as much as $900 million in revenue. So there's a market for old-time vinyl records. Some people say they think it sounds better. I've heard people say that it's a warmer sound. And even though it's not as crisp as digital music, it has, again, that warmer sound to it. So some people really like putting a record on and playing it, and they feel like it sounds better. So you'll see record stores out there sometimes in different areas. Like I said, I've seen record players being sold at stores again. And so it's interesting. Maybe if you're a vinyl fan, now you can get all the new music there again on some of those records. So no one's talking about the 8-track coming back. That's one thing that I don't think anybody wants to come back, is the 8-track. And I haven't heard anything about cassettes either, even though that's not as long ago. But the records, that seems to have a place in people's hearts. So vinyl comeback. Sony's going to make records again after a 28-year break. That's just an interesting story. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. And we're online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com. Lots of great places that you can join us. So we appreciate you being at those different areas with us today. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show coming up this weekend with your host, Stephen Fleury. One of the programs this weekend is about some of the recent history of the UK and the royal family over there. It's not been a great history recently. Some very interesting activities surrounding the throne over there in Britain. And so make sure you listen for that program. Really interesting. Definitely a change going on over there in what some of the activities that the royal family is involved in. As is brought on the show, it's almost like on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, it's almost like a reality show over there now, which, of course, reality shows are so popular in many parts of the West. But some of the things seem almost to be like that. So anyway, really interesting show. Great history brought out. Make sure you listen for that. Also, the Trumpet Hour Week in Review program, that'll be coming your way also. And stop and check out thetrumpet.com, some of the stories that you can see. Top story, what the Paris Climate Agreement was really about. Really, really important article. You've heard a lot about climate control and climate change and climate agreement and all of that. And so what's it really about, though? That's the important question. It says it was deeply significant, but not for the reasons people think. That's by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief and Key of David presenter Gerald Fleury. Make sure you read that. what the Paris Climate Agreement was really about. Also related to that, a Trumpet Talk video, Three Things the Mainstream Media Isn't Telling You About Climate Change. That's by Andrew Miller, and you can find that at thetrumpet.com. Stop and check all that out. And over the weekend, if you got some time, it's a good time to catch up on some of the programming here from KPCG or some of the write-ups at thetrumpet.com. Also, if you go to thetrumpet.com, if you haven't signed up yet, sign up for the Trumpet Brief. It's an email that gets sent out several times a week. Just some good write-ups about some of the things going on in the news. Really great. It's you can get through them in a few minutes, but there's great information there. And again, it's a free service. You can sign up for that at thetrumpet.com. Well, a really interesting story today. It's always encouraging in some ways, or exciting to hear about a young person that's doing something really extraordinary. And sometimes it makes us think about ourselves, like, well, maybe I could be extraordinary too. An 11-year-old boy from Reading has scored 162 in an intelligence quotient test, IQ test, as we know it, according to the British newspaper, The Independent. His name is Arnav Sharma, of Indian origin, and he told The Independent he recently passed the difficult Mensa test with no preparation. His mark, the maximum possible result you can achieve on the paper, puts him in the top 1% of the nation in terms of IQ level. So I guess that's up there on Einstein's level, according to what I read. So, but that's always such an interesting question, isn't it? It's fascinating. You've probably taken an IQ test. I did, certainly in school. They didn't tell us what our results were. I guess we could all be geniuses in my class, or we could have all been dummies, but we don't know. They never told us. You can take tests online. I don't know how accurate they are. But something people wonder about, what's my IQ? How smart am I? How intelligent am I? And how do you even gauge something like that? It's really interesting. And so there's some ideas about that. I'm going to play a clip for you here. It's about a 10-minute clip. It's pretty interesting. It's off of YouTube. And they're talking about the controversy of intelligence. And the title is Controversy of Intelligence, Crash Course Psychology Number 23. Pretty entertaining. The guy's a great presenter. And they talk about some of the history of how people try to measure intelligence. I think you'll find it interesting. I'll play that for you and then be back with a few stories also related to intelligence. This is, again, Controversy of Intelligence, Crash Course Psychology Number 23.
What if I'm the world's greatest Rubik's Cube solver, but a terrible speller, or a truly gifted artist who's barely mastered long division? Could anyone say I was intelligent or not based on those different aptitudes, or would it be more accurate to measure my brain power on several different scales? Around the turn of the 20th century, British psychologist Charles Spearman suggested that yes, we do have one comprehensive general intelligence that underlies all of our specific mental abilities. He called it the G factor. Spearman conceded that while people may have special talents like basket weaving, or saxophone solos, or doing crossword puzzles, those things still fell under G. And he helped develop a statistical procedure called factor analysis to try to determine how certain clusters of skills might correlate with another one. Like, say, someone who tests well in spatial skills might be good with numbers. We might then refer to that cluster of skills, that factor, as spatial numeric reasoning. But to Spearman, the G factor was something of an uber factor, connected to all intelligent behavior from architecture to healing to survival skills. And it's why people who do well on one kind of cognitive test tend to do well on others. But as you can imagine, reducing intelligence to a single numerical test score was and is problematic. L.L. Thurstone, an American pioneer of psychometrics and one of Spearman's first challengers, was not into ranking people on a single scale. Thurstone administered 56 different tests to his subjects, then used them to identify 7 clusters of mental abilities. By this system, you might turn out to be great at, like, verbal comprehension, but less stellar at something like numerical ability. Sounds fair. But when researchers followed up on his findings, they actually did see that high scores in one aptitude usually meant good scores in the others, essentially backing up some evidence for some kind of G factor. Even though their ideas did not often align, Spearman and Thurstone together paved the way for more contemporary theories on intelligence. For example, American psychologist Howard Gardner views intelligence as multiple abilities that come in different forms. He references instances of brain damage where one ability may be destroyed while others stay perfectly intact. intact. Savants usually have some limited mental abilities, but one exceptional ability when it comes to, like, computing figures or memorizing the complete works of Shakespeare. To Gardner, this suggests that we have multiple intelligences beyond the G factor. In fact, he believes that we have 8 intelligences, ranging from our skills with numbers and words to our ability to understand physical space and the natural world. American psychologist Robert Sternberg tends to agree with Gardner, though he boils them down into 3 intelligences: analytical or problem-solving intelligence, creative intelligence, or the ability to adapt to new situations, and practical intelligence for everyday tasks. Both of these models seem reasonable, too, and Gardner and Sternberg's work has helped teachers appreciate students' variety of talents. But research has suggested that even these different ways to be smart are also linked by some underlying general intelligence factor. So what about other less tangible forms of intelligence, like creativity, our ability to produce ideas that are both novel and valuable? How could a test that demands one correct answer account for more creative solutions, so-called divergent thinking? Well, traditional intelligence tests can't. And so far, while we do have some tests that look at creative potential, we don't have a standardized system for quantifying creativity. But Sternberg and his colleagues have identified 5 main components of creativity, which are useful for framing our understanding of what creative intelligence is and how it works. And when you go through the list, you know who I think is really great at almost all of them? Sherlock Holmes. Hear me out. First, we got expertise, or a well-developed base of knowledge. This just means knowing a lot about a lot, whether it's arcane poisons, jellyfish behavior, or how to recognize a secret passage behind a bookshelf. Expertise provides the mind with all sorts of data to work with and combine in new ways. Obviously, Sherlock has incredible imaginative thinking skills too, which provide him with the ability to see things in new ways, recognize patterns, and make connections. He loves nothing more than rehashing these breadcrumb trails for the dopey constables at the end of a case. Sternberg also thought a venturesome personality contributes to creativity. By hanging around opium dens and chasing thugs and generally courting danger, Sherlock routinely seeks new experiences, tolerates risk, and perseveres in overcoming obstacles. And everyone knows he's driven by intrinsic motivation. I mean, he wants to help the widow discover the thief and everything, but really, Sherlock is driven by his own interest and sense of challenge. He gets pleasure from the work itself. And finally, Sherlock benefits from a creative environment which sparks, supports, and refines his ideas. For so affectionately maintaining this environment on Sherlock's behalf, we largely have Dr. Watson to thank. Sherlock was obviously an academic and creative genius, but he was pretty weak in another form of intelligence, the emotional kind. Emotional intelligence, defined in 1997 by psychologists Peter Salovey and John Mayer, not that one, is the ability to perceive, understand, manage, and use emotions. I don't know about you, but I know plenty of smart people who have a hard time processing social information. The most brilliant mathematician may struggle to communicate with colleagues and neighbors or staff at the local deli. Likewise, Sherlock often annoys, offends, or even baffles those around him. Perceiving emotions means being able to recognize them in faces and even music and film and stories. Understanding emotions relates to being able to predict them and how they might change, and managing emotions comes down to knowing how to appropriately express yourself in various situations. And finally, emotional intelligence also means using emotions to enable adaptive or creative thinking, like knowing how to manage conflict or comfort a grieving friend or work well with others. Much like creative intelligence, emotional intelligence can be measured to some degree through testing, but there's no standardized way to, like, assign a numerical value. So if we can't perfectly quantify things like creativity or emotional smarts, how did we come up with a way to measure intelligence? Well, as I mentioned earlier, it's a sordid story. The first attempts to do it in the Western world began with English scientist Francis Galton in the 1800s. Taking a page from his famous cousin Charles Darwin's theories on natural selection, Galton wondered how that premise might extend to humans' natural ability when it came to intelligence. He suggested that our smarts have a lot to do with heredity, so if we encourage smart people to breed with each other, we could essentially create a master race of geniuses. If that sounds a little sketchy, it's because it was, like, really, really sketchy. This study of how to selectively and supposedly improve a human population, especially by encouraging breeding in some people and discouraging it in others, is called eugenics, a term Galton himself coined, and I'll get back to in a minute. But around the turn of the 20th century, when eugenics was taking off, the French government mandated that all children must attend school. Many of these kids had never been in a classroom, and teachers wanted to figure out how they could identify kids who needed extra help. Enter Alfred Binet and Theodore Simon, Simone, two French psychologists who were commissioned to develop a test to measure a child's so-called mental age. The concept of a kid's mental age is essentially the level of performance associated with a certain chronological age. So if six-year-old Bruno tests as well as the average six-year-old, he'd have a mental age of six. Binet believed that his tests could measure a child's current mental abilities, but that intelligence wasn't a fixed inborn thing. He believed a person's capabilities could be raised with proper attention, self-discipline, and practice. In other words, he was no eugenicist. He was hoping that his tests would improve children's education by identifying those who needed extra attention. But Binet also feared that these tests would, in the wrong hands, be used to do just the opposite, labeling children as lost causes, limiting their opportunities. And wow, was he onto something, because that is pretty much exactly what happened. German psychologist William Stern used revisions of Binet and Simone's work to create the famous intelligence quotient, or IQ measurement. At the time, your IQ was simply your mental age divided by your chronological age multiplied by 100. So, for example, Bruno is 6, and so is his mental age, so his IQ ranks at 100, but his little sister Betty is a 4-year-old with a mental age of 5, so her IQ would be 125. That formula works pretty well for measuring kids, but it falls apart when it comes to adults who don't hit measurable developmental steps like kids do. I mean, there's no real difference between a mental age of 34 and 35. But Stanford professor Lewis Terman started promoting the widespread use of intelligence testing in the early 1900s, and with his help, the U.S. government began the world's first mass administration of intelligence tests when it assessed World War I Army recruits and immigrants fresh off the boat. Unlike Binet, Terman did use these numerical findings as a kind of label, and he thought his tests could, as he put it, ultimately result in curtailing the reproduction of feeble-mindedness. This kind of testing played right into eugenicist sensibilities, and soon the eugenics movement in the U.S. had a pretty good fan club, raising money from the Carnegies and Rockefellers, and with proponents working at Harvard and Columbia and Cornell. In the first half of the 20th century, intelligence tests were used to enforce the sterilization of around 60,000 people, around a third of whom were in California. Most were poor white women, often unwed mothers or prostitutes. Other eugenics efforts persisted further into the century, and there's evidence of poor African American, Native American, or Latina women being forcibly or covertly sterilized in large numbers as recently as the 1970s. But you know who really loved their eugenics? The Nazis. Hitler and his cronies took the idea of intelligence testing to even darker conclusions. The Nazis were all about selecting against so-called feeble-mindedness and other undesirable traits as they sought to strengthen what they saw as their Aryan nation. They sterilized or simply executed hundreds of thousands of victims based on their answers to IQ test questions that were really more about adhering to social norms than measuring actual intelligence. Questions like, who was Bismarck and what does Christmas signify? So you can see how this terrifying history still makes some people leery of how such tests are administered, interpreted, and weighted. Today, we understand that intelligence, as defined by all the people we've talked about here, does appear to be a real and measurable phenomenon. But no one can say that they've disentangled all of the would-be genetic, environmental, educational, and socioeconomic components of it. In the end, it's best to think of intelligence as something about which we've still got a lot to learn, and next week, we'll talk about how we test intelligence today and the problems we still face in doing it. Today, you're in Intelligent Mind learned about the history of how we think about and define different types of intelligence, what the G factor is, and how Sherlock Holmes is incredibly intelligent but emotionally unintelligent. You also learned about the history and methods of intelligence testing, IQ scores, and how eugenics turned to the dark side and has since made even talking about intelligence kind of controversial. Thank you for watching, especially to our Subbable subscribers who make Crash Course possible. To find out how you can become a supporter, just go to subbable.com/crashcourse. This episode was written by Kathleen Yale, edited by Blake T. Pastino, and our consultant is Dr. Ranjit Bhagwat. Our director and editor is Nicholas Jenkins. The script supervisor is Michael Aranda, who is also our sound designer, and the graphics team is Thought Cafe.
After hearing all that, you feel like you need to take a break, take a breath. That guy, he talks fast. He's good at it. Lots of information there. I thought it was interesting. Hopefully you found it interesting as well. I mean, you probably knew some of it, and maybe you've heard some of it before, especially with eugenics. There's a lot of written about that. But it is interesting. They just, you know, it's like he said at the end of that piece, there's a lot to learn about intelligence and IQ and how people, how their minds work. It is something that man still hasn't totally figured out, probably by any stretch, but they try to measure it in some ways. And some people do really well in those particular tests, like the example of this 11-year-old boy that I'd mentioned before that piece, Arnav Sharma, who he's from Britain over there. And he had the highest possible result that he could achieve on this Mensa test for his IQ. And so it was very high, up in the one percentile. So I don't know. It's interesting. It'd be interesting to look at. And there's probably studies out there that I haven't looked at yet, though. But people that have measured extremely high on the IQ test, what did they go on to do? I mean, do they go on to be successful? Like that piece pointed out, people can be very intelligent in a certain way, but then not be emotionally intelligent. So they don't know how to interact with other people very well, and that can be an issue. You know, so there's all kinds of questions about it. I think it's a fascinating subject. But one of the things that's happening in society today is because of the advancements in technology and people being able to share knowledge and information, is we're developing artificial intelligence as well in machines. Obviously, in computers, we all probably have a smartphone. That's a computer. And in the way that jobs are even being done. And so people are concerned about, is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing to automate all sorts of processes? This was sent in by a listener. These robots are changing the face of fast food. They look at the example of just that industry for the most part. And we mentioned something about this the other day. But it's a couple of companies that they're developing machines that can do the jobs that certain humans would do. Through this, artificial intelligence. Momentum Machines, it's a company in San Francisco, a tech company. They've created a fully autonomous robot capable of churning out 400 burgers in an hour. The job of burger flipping is now becoming a machine's job, which, you know, it's not the greatest job in the world, but teenagers and others sometimes have to do it, and it is replacing that in some ways. It's an innovation that could drastically impact restaurant workers. Pasadena-based Mizo Robotics has created a machine dubbed Flippy. We talked about Flippy a while ago, which they say, you guessed it, flips patties to perfection by use of an automated claw-like machine and AI software. One of the things that's driving this is the rise in minimum wage. Last year, minimum wage workers protested across the country in the fight for a wage of $15 per hour as fast food chains are grappling with these demands for higher wages. Turning to automation could offset costs. The machines can produce more food more quickly and reduce food waste by eliminating human error. They also don't get sick, they don't need a paycheck, and they don't get hurt on the job. Although I guess you'd have to repair them from time to time. And so they're making more automation because of one of the reasons being the minimum wage going up. They say that makes investing in an automated flipping burger machine more cost-effective than hiring an employee. Vado, this gentleman's name, quite a long, odd name, but anyway, he told this write-up that a single machine could replace upwards of 3 full-time employees, and it would save each burger franchise that this machine is at, $90,000 a year. And the machine doesn't get grumpy typically either, unless it's not working, I guess. Roughly 38% of U.S. jobs could be replaced by robots within the next 15 years or so, according to research published by professional service network PricewaterhouseCoopers. Tech companies have already made headway into self-driving cars, potentially eliminating the need for cars, bus, and truck drivers, although I'd still want to see that actually work, robotic pharmacists, and robotic bricklayers, to name a few. Those are jobs that might be going away because they're developing these robotic ways to automate it with artificial intelligence. So man's intelligence versus the intelligence of a machine, and it is interesting. And of course, somebody has to invent that and make those machines work, and that's man's intelligence that's working there. Stephen Hawking said, it's likely to be either the best or worst thing ever to happen to humanity. So, well, yeah, that's pretty drastic there. It's either going to be the best or the worst. I don't think it'll be either one of those, but it is a changing time that we live in. Artificial intelligence is doing a lot of things now, including maybe determining whether or not you get hired in the first place. There was a movie years ago, I think it was called Minority Report, where they were trying to predict who would commit crimes. It's kind of a scary thought that because you would get pigeonholed as a person, like, well, we think this person will do this, therefore, you know, I think the movie went on to suggest that they would stop it before it happened. And so kind of an interesting thought. But they're actually starting to do this in terms of employment. This is a write-up from Fortune magazine. It says, a few years ago, Jason Friedman was confronted by a classic hiring challenge. He had a 10-person startup that he had founded. It was an online commercial real estate service called 42floors.com. It's growing, and he needed more employees. And suddenly, Friedman, who had a lot of other duties, including being the CEO, was spending hours at a time sifting through towering stacks of resumes. He found himself to be overwhelmed because, of course, he had other jobs to do, but he needed more employees, and he needs valuable employees at that. And so he had this conundrum. He didn't have time to go through all of these resumes that were sent in. The solution appeared, they say, in the form of artificial intelligence software from a young company called Interviewed. It speeds the vetting process by providing online simulations of what applicants might do on their first day as an employee. Now, I guess if it favored you, that would be good. But if it looked at whatever the data input was and said, we don't think that person will do well, well, that would be horrible. You don't even have a chance to sort of prove yourself. So it could be good in some ways, but in other ways it could be bad. It says the software does much more than grade multiple choice questions. It can capture not only so-called book knowledge, but also more intangible human qualities. It uses natural language processing and machine learning to construct a psychological profile that predicts whether a person will fit a company's culture. It's fascinating. That includes assessing which words he or she favors. A penchant for using please and thank you, for example, shows empathy and a possible disposition for working with customers. And measuring how well the applicant can juggle conversations and still pay attention to detail. They say we can look at 4,000 candidates and within a few days whittle it down to the top 2 to 3%, according to Friedman, who worked with this company. He says, 48 hours later, we've hired someone. It's not perfect, but he said it's faster and it's better than the human way. So they say we can develop, or they have developed, a computer program, artificial intelligence, that can determine which humans will do a job better than, say, a human could determine it. As it used to be, and still is in many cases, but really interesting. Like that I don't know. I don't know that I'm comfortable with that. That seems like they're trying to put sort of like human prerogatives or human functions into an artificial intelligence. And there's a real difference there, of course, if you understand anything about the human spirit. And there's a lot of write-ups about that at thetrumpet.com. Machines, they don't have that. They can't think. They can't process things the same way that human beings can. They're certainly not on the level that we do, that humans do. So it's really interesting to see this sort of convergence between functions that humans used to do and now artificial intelligence is starting to do them as well. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Well, in a lot of cases, it seems like technology that man develops could have a good use, but then a lot of times it ends up having a bad use and not being used correctly. So it'll be interesting to see if this is one of those good ones or one of those bad ones. A little further down this write-up, it says, people prefer to make judgments about other people, of course. Of course they do. I don't want a machine telling me. It says, but it turns out we're not very good at it, according to some of the research. Yale School of Management professor Jason Dana, who has studied hiring for years, recently made waves with a high-profile article in the New York Times that said job interviews were useless. He says they can be harmful, undercutting the impact of other more valuable information about interviewees. Among other things, he noted the tendency by hiring managers to turn impressions from a conversation into a coherent but often incorrect narrative. A Google veteran agrees with him and says, most interviews are a waste of time because 99.4% of the time is spent trying to confirm whatever impression the interviewer formed in the first 10 seconds. And so they're trying to say that humans are not very good at determining what other humans are going to do, and that might be true, but they think that their software, their artificial intelligence, can make a much more accurate prediction. But so where does that stop? I mean, it's bad enough if it's a hiring thing. Your fate's on the line with this artificial intelligence. But what if it becomes something else? Like, again, you know, who's likely to commit a crime? Who's likely to do this? Who's likely to do that? It does start to get into the realm of, like, movies, like sci-fi movies that have been out there in the past. So that's interesting write-up from Fortune Magazine. Artificial intelligence is doing a lot of things, including maybe determining who gets a job and who doesn't. They have another little note here that might be worth looking at. Five insights on hiring that AI is building on. So the artificial intelligence is trying to build on these five insights when someone's looking for a job. Number one, they say forget about the grades. GPAs and test scores are worthless as criteria, according to research Google did on its own hiring. I mean, maybe that's true to a point, but if you're hiring an engineer and they got Fs in all their engineering courses, I would think that would be a good indication they shouldn't have the job. But they say it found that the proportion of people without any college education at Google has increased over time, and up to 14% of those on some teams never went to college. So they say that probably doesn't matter. Don't tell the colleges that. They'll have to lower their prices. Second thing they say is that artificial intelligence is trying to build on when it comes to jobs and determining who to hire, is that grit matters more than IQ. University of Pennsylvania professor Angela Duckworth studied military cadets, rookie teachers in tough neighborhoods, and new salespeople to determine who would endure and succeed. The common thread wasn't IQ, social intelligence, looks, or health. It was passion and persistence, she said. So I think that would be true in a lot of cases. They say experience also isn't everything when it comes to hiring. A study by the American Association of Inside Sales Professionals and AI startup Koru concluded that experience didn't predict sales success. Another found that grads with mid-level roles in extracurriculars outperformed club presidents. And notice why. Because companies needed team players more than stars. It's true, right? I mean, unless you're getting hired to be the boss or you're starting your own company, everybody's kind of a team player. And they say that those that come on and want to be the star doesn't usually work so well. Number four, they say their star may not be your star. A person who excelled at a rival may fizzle at your firm. Some 75% of these artificial intelligence predictors vary even among similar roles at similar companies. At one, the number of hours worked in college might be a predictor, while taking psychology courses, an indicator of teamwork, is a predictor of another. The match is crucial. So they're looking at some of those things, trying to determine who to hire via artificial intelligence. And finally, they say ignore that Facebook photo. A study by AI company Fama found that pictures of certain things on social accounts that may not be the best don't imply bad job performance. Such photos are so common that screening for them means eliminating huge swaths of people. By contrast, bigoted comments or posts about drugs were linked to subpar for performance. So anyway, there's maybe some truth to some of those things. Other things might be a little more questionable, but when it comes to getting a job, some companies now want you to just put some information in, and they're going to run you through software and determine via artificial intelligence and some predictors what type of an employee you will be. Are you comfortable with that? I don't think I am. I don't think I like that. I'd rather get to talk to somebody and then maybe have a chance to prove myself. So interesting, the change in the way things are being done in some sectors. The intelligence of man versus the intelligence of machines and software and so forth. Of course, all programmed by men in the first place. One other note before we close today, speaking of human beings and how they perform, say, considering or against machines, how do they perform against animals? Do you know that happens sometimes? That humans, they will have races and such with other animals to see who is the fastest? It says from Time Magazine, taking on the animal kingdom. There's a few events that have happened where humans have actually won. Doesn't happen often. Cheetahs. In 2013, two NFL players were pitted against a pair of cheetahs for a National Geography Wild documentary. The Chicago Bears' Devin Hester, who, if you know football, was extremely fast as a kick returner, punt returner, won the race by milliseconds. I don't know how far they ran, but he outran a cheetah. That's bragging rights. You can say you're faster than a cheetah. Humans have challenged chimps. U.S. Navy SEAL Scott Helvenston beat a chimpanzee in an obstacle course race on reality show Man vs. Beast in 2003. Never heard of that show. Another competitor lost a hot dog eating contest to a bear. I would think so. But anyway, that Navy SEAL was able to beat the chimpanzee. I suppose a lot of it would depend on which chimpanzee you picked. I suppose some would be faster than others, but still pretty impressive. However, You're not going to out-eat a bear when it comes to hot dogs, I don't think. Unless the bear just doesn't care about them. And then finally, there was a show. Well, that's actually a marathon. It's called Man vs. Horse, where humans run against horses. It's a marathon that's been annually run in a rural town in Wales since 1980. The endurance race has been won by a human only twice in its 37-year history. So in most cases, when it comes to just physical feats of strength and speed, the animals are going to win it. But they are not thinkers. Their minds don't work. But there are times when humans have outperformed the animals, even in the physical tasks. So kind of interesting to look at some of that, just in terms of intelligence, human performance, artificial intelligence, all of those things. Again, it has a lot to do with the human spirit and the human potential. That's one thing man just is always struggling to try to figure out. What's the potential of man? What could we unlock here? There's a great write-up about that, a great book at thetrumpet.com, The Incredible Human Potential. Make sure you stop and check that out. It's free. It'll give you a lot of amazing insight into that topic. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining me today and this week. Make sure you listen for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, Kia David and Trumpet Hour Week in Review this weekend, along with the rest of the programming. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you again tomorrow. You're listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.